Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the broadside levelled against the CIA and the White House by outgoing Senator Mark Udall, a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee who fought for the release of the torture report, who said in a dramatic floor speech in the Senate that it's bad enough to not prosecute these CIA officials, but to reward and promote them is incomprehensible. The president needs to purge his administration. Veteran CIA officer Robert Baer joins us to discuss why the internal CIA report on torture, which came to the same conclusions as the Senate report, and was the reason why the CIA spied on the Senate to see who leaked the report to them, will never see the light of day. Then Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell, joins us to discuss the report's revelations that the Bush White House went out of their way to keep his boss Colin Powell in the dark when the Bush White House abandoned the moral high ground as they embraced the dark side in response to the 9/11 attacks. We'll also look into the extent to which Vice President Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice should be held responsible for the torture regime that they championed, directed, and managed, along with elements within the CIA who followed their orders. Then finally, we will speak with Robert McChesney, the Gutzel Endowed Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois and author of the new book, Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, Media, Politics, and the Struggle for Post-Capitalist Democracy. We will discuss how we can overcome the downward spiral created by the tyranny of wealth and privilege in America and establish a truly democratic and sustainable society. And joining us now is Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He is the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil, the basis of the acclaimed film Syriana, which earned George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Baer. He is considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and frequently appears on all major news outlets and writes frequently for Time.com and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. His latest book just out is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Great to be here, Ian.
And there was a very dramatic floor speech today in the Senate from Mark Udall, who, of course, has been voted out. And he's been one of the champions of transparency in getting this Senate Select Intelligence Committee report out. And he basically is accusing the White House of aiding and abetting the CIA in covering up and holding up this report. And he called on the president to purge the CIA. What's the what do you think the likelihood of that happening is?
This president taking on his friend John Brennan, zero. It's not going to happen. I mean, it's, you know, an honorable gesture, you know, to state the facts, to say the torture didn't work, and I don't think it did. But you're not going to see this president taking on his own national security establishment, especially John Brennan. They go too far back. There's too many people on the right that are just not going to allow this to happen, and this president pays attention to the right.
Well, it seems, though, that what Udall was saying in his speech today was that on the Senate floor, he was making the point that the never-released internal CIA report that began under Leon Panetta, in fact, supported much of the Senate report's findings, and that's the very reason why the CIA took the extraordinary steps of spying on the Senate staffers to find out how they'd gained access to the CIA internal report. What's your understanding about that report?
It's referred to as the Panetta Review, which is damning as the Senate report. You know, so here the problem is, the CIA found out, in terms of finding bin Laden, found out who the courier was on 1 January 2002, long before the torture started. That was a guy they were following and would take years to run him to ground. But in the meantime, they started arresting people who confirmed the existence of the so-called courier. And some of the information was tortured out of them. And what they're doing, the CIA is saying, well, look, we started to believe this once the torture happened. You know, I don't think it happened that way. But it's all very confusing. And what worries the CIA and the White House is if the Panetta Review were to be released, it would confirm what I just said, that the information was obtained in classical interrogations and from sources and the rest of it in other liaison services. So, I mean, here's the problem is the CIA went down the road of torture. I understand why they did, because they knew nothing about al-Qaeda at the beginning, and they were desperate to get sources, and they had no other way that all these governments were turning these people over to them. They didn't really know what to do with them. They weren't talking at first. In context, it was, can I call it an honest mistake? It was honest in the sense that they thought they would get something out of it. Then it just it perpetuated. It went on and on. And once you get a resource like this, you don't want to give it up. I mean, it's a giant bureaucracy. If you've got prisons all around the world and airplanes and you've got all this movement, it keeps bureaucrats happy. And it was only after 6 or 7 years that they figured out they're not getting anything out of this, and they dropped it. But I think you and I would agree that if we were given the choice, if there was a plane ready to be blown out of the sky, and to save 300 people, we had to waterboard one person, I think sort of everybody would say, yes, if that were 100% certainty, you could save that airplane, we'd all agree. But the problem is the smoking gun hypothesis never happens, which then in effect makes torture immoral and ineffective.
And one of the people, of course, that who the report points out as being, as directing and managing the CIA's torture regime is the very same person who ignored all the prior warnings before 9/11 that al-Qaeda was determined to attack the United States. I refer to Condoleezza Rice. And what about though going after the architects, which many people are now suggesting should be what is being done? How much would the CIA have done this without Cheney coming over there and bullying them? And how much would they have done it without whatever the deal was made? Remember when shortly after 9/11, President Bush went over to the CIA and put his arm around George Tenet, and basically that looked like a deal where I'm not going to blame you for screwing up, and you're not going to blame me for screwing up.
Look, I went to college with George Tenet. I know the guy. I know the way he thinks. I've been around him a long time, both in the CIA and out. He's not a courageous man. John Rizzo, the general counsel, through all this, I know him as well. He's not a rogue player. The pressure came from the top. It came from Condoleezza Rice, Dick Cheney, and the same crew we all hear about. They were determined to go to the dark side as quickly as possible. Why they turned to the CIA is because Rumsfeld wouldn't put up with this. He said, I'm not going to turn the military, open up secret prisons and run this. He flat out said, no, I've talked to people. He said, this is just too dangerous. This is going to blow up. So Bush and company went after the weak player, and that was George Tenet. And his executive director, of course, at the time was John Brennan. And they were sort of a pair at that point. They'd been a pair in the White House. And Tenet brought him in as executive director at the same time. Neither of them are particularly courageous politically. I'm not saying they're not courageous. They just don't have standing in Washington, nothing like Cheney did or Rumsfeld. So they went along with the program, and never mind that nobody at the CIA had ever done a hostile interrogation. And I'll say that flat out. It just never happened. The CIA didn't hire interrogators. They wanted nothing to do with it. They didn't know what they were doing. So then what happens then, they're looking at each other now that this deal's been made, and they say, what do? Well, like we do everything else, we outsource it. And this is where they go to Mitchell and Jessen, two guys who had also never done interrogation, but they had a great con going. They eventually extracted, according to the report, $81 million for their services, and I'm not even sure what those services were, except, you know, use more water. It's insane, the whole scenario. And I think the CIA internally figured, I knew they at the moment they were making these decisions, CIA officers I know were saying, this is crazy. We go down this road and we're going to pay the price one day. We're absolutely right. Eventually the bureaucracy caught up and it was put forward. This is not working. It's not saving lives because we're still facing the same terror attacks, but no one's thinking about going to enhanced interrogations or torture now because they know it doesn't work. So, I mean, this is the CIA has a stain on it. It's all these defenders of the people who initiated this program made the mistake in the first place, so they're defending their reputation. That's what it is, not the facts. And we're stuck with this. And even with the sadder part of all this is that the CIA, in fact, did run Bin Laden to ground, and it was done through classical espionage. It was done, through sources, intercepts, and the rest of it. But they can't talk about it. They don't want to talk about it. All they care about is defending their reputation right now.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, who's one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil, the basis for the acclaimed film Syriana, which earned George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Baer. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and frequently appears on all major news outlets and writes regularly for Time.com and is the current national security affairs analyst for CNN. His latest book just out is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassination. Now, these two characters, James Mitchell and Bruce Jensen, who got $81 million for their so-called services, the Mitchell's gone public and is defending what they did, but without giving details. And when asked about his credentials, he said that he signed a secrecy agreement with the CIA and can't discuss them. My understanding is that his credentials are that he worked for the Air Force, and when he was given this extraordinary contract by the CIA, they just revived this old Korean War era program where they trained airmen who could be shot down by the North Koreans or the Chinese communists, and trained them in how to endure torture. But the purpose of the Chinese communists and the North Koreans' torture during the Korean War was not to extract valuable, actionable intelligence, but rather to break these prisoners. And, that was what they did. They didn't, it was all about getting them to make false confessions. So what's the...
Exactly. It's waterboarding. You ask the SEALs. SEALs use it voluntarily with trainees. It's used with SEALs that think they literally walk on water and they can't be tortured. They won't be affected. And they say, oh, yeah, you want to see this? And they put them under waterboarding for a couple minutes. And they say, you're right. But it was never, the SEER program, so-called, this, special forces stuff, it was never meant to interrogate prisoners. I mean, the Israelis went through this, the whole smoking gun hypothesis, and the Supreme Court in Israel outlawed it. I mean, it just doesn't work. And the Israelis backed off, and they're not scared of anything. So... And no one's looked at this scientifically, and especially these two contractors the CIA hired had never interrogated anybody. They just found some old manuals and say, yeah, it's good enough, we'll try this. And then and all the rest of the people, the case officers that I know that were sent out, were like me. They were trained to run agents to do things like this, but never run an interrogation program or put people under stress for months at a time. You can't read manuals about this stuff and make it work.
Well, but doesn't this also get to the post 9/11 gravy train for contractors, whether it's Halliburton in Iraq or Booz Allen Hamilton at the NSA, or these characters who got $81 million for recycling some old Korean War pamphlet?
It was greed and stupidity which took over after 9/11. I think it's just so clear. Or even take Snowden, who was getting $250,000 a year, and he was a high school dropout. I mean, that's a lot of money in anybody's book. I mean, the contractors were all over Washington making fortunes. And you go to Washington now, you go down to 9th Street. When I first moved, that place was burnt out. Now it's nicer than Beverly Hills or Fifth Avenue. I mean, it's just money is pouring into Washington, and this is just another, facet of it, this bogus interrogation program.
So is there any way, though, that, and it's never happened as far as I know, where the executive branch has actually been held accountable for what they tasked the CIA to do, whether you go back to Jack Kennedy, who swore after the Bay of Pigs to smash the CIA to 1,000 pieces, and then ended up using them with a vengeance. And so Jimmy Carter got elected essentially against the CIA because of the Church Committee reports that came out prior at the end of the Ford administration. And there was this kind of backlash that he rode in onto the White House, but then he ended up using the CIA with a vengeance. And my understanding is that during the Cold War, all presidents had, when dealing with the Soviet Union, had the choices were either the useless or the unusable, the useless being a diplomatic letter of protest for Soviet misbehavior, and the unusable being the thermonuclear arsenal. So the range of options in between were filled up by the CIA, and they became the favorite toy of the executive branch.
And when
it's a catastrophe, truly, because the CIA is not, it's a civilian organization. They have a lot of smart people. They come in dedicated. Admittedly, they leave very quickly, the smart ones. But it's politically misused in Washington, always has been. You know, you look at the Bay of Pigs, 1961. Let's take all these Cubans and have them invade Cuba. It was never workable. And the analysts on the desk said it wasn't workable. So what the White House did was cut out the analysts. And anybody who knew Cuba was cut out. It's like in the Middle East. We're going to fight this war on terror, but we don't want the experts in the way. You know, I've said this before in the press, but the people who ran the invasion of Iraq in 2003, the false intelligence and weapons of mass destruction, the entire interrogation program, were people all new to the Middle East. And Jose Rodriguez, the person head of operations, they were all pulled out of Central and South America. They were Latin American specialists. They didn't speak a word of Arabic. They knew nothing about Muslims, but they were pliable and compliant. And the White House could say, all right, we want this done. We want a torture program. And these guys didn't have a clue the way Al-Qaeda worked. And that's the way it was run. And Jose Rodriguez was a Latin American body, was put in head of the Counterterrorism Center. It's crazy. Counterterrorism Center had to do with Al-Qaeda. So why take somebody, a specialist who speaks Spanish, put him in charge of the Middle East? They did it because they knew he would go along with things because he didn't know what he was doing.
Well, but this still continues. I just was looking at a piece the other day on the news where the Islamic State have these sophisticated recruiting videos that they put out on YouTube that supposedly attract young Muslims from the diaspora to come and fight with them. And the U.S. government's decided to create their own videos to counteract the success of the Islamic State. And who do they put in charge of making these videos for YouTube? Another one of these Latinos from the Jose Rodriguez operation. So it's still going on.
It still goes on. I mean, nothing changed under this president. I mean, there was no house cleaning. There was no attempt to fix the CIA in the sense that it does run well when it's left alone, when it's not drawn into politics. You know, is this ever going to change? It's never in the past. I don't see why it should now.
So what do you think, though, is the likely, I mean, it seems to be polarized along political lines where it's being considered a kind of Democratic report because of Senator Feinstein's a Democrat. And most of the Republicans, with the exception of Lindsey Graham and John McCain, are attacking it and suggesting that torture worked, et cetera. Is there any way that it could ever get beyond partisan politics, or do you just think this is dead on arrival, this one, because it's...
I think it's dead on arrival. I think you could, if someone really wanted to, they could sit down with the interrogation transcripts from these things and look at what resulted from the torture and figure out whether it added anything. This is all, you can see this if you look into the chronologies of it. I don't see anybody appointing a nonpartisan commission of respected people. I'd even say Colin Powell, and let him look through it and let him do his work alone and everybody shut up. But I just don't see it happening. For some reason, the Republicans have decided that this is an issue that they're going to beat the Democrats with over national security. But I think it could be resolved by fact. It is something knowable. But you look at the dialogue now, it's got nothing to do with the facts. I mean,
well, but apart from you,
I'm not optimistic.
But I'm saying, apart from Udall, I don't see anybody standing up and saying, wait a minute, you know, the CIA did their own internal report that apparently came to pretty much the same conclusions as the Senate Select Intelligence report that was held up forever and a day and redacted. Why not, demand the release of that report? Because that would have more credibility if it comes from the very agency that's now disowning this report that's apparently pretty much the same as the one that they did internally.
Well, the CIA is not going to release it because it's another damning report or the Inspector General's report and on. They're not going to let people talk about it. And they just don't feel that they're in a position to admit mistakes. And this president could declassify this stuff. This stuff is redactable, so it's readable. I mean, you don't have to take out every word. It's not sources and methods that would be exposed. It's just political, unpalatable truths. that this president doesn't feel he's strong enough to take on, and he probably isn't strong enough with the new Republican Senate. And the Republicans aren't going to look at this, the facts. I mean, they're going to defend the Bush legacy, you know, planning for the next Bush administration. And that's it's not any deeper than that.
Well, Robert Baer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, who's one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil, the basis for the acclaimed film Syriana, which earned George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Baer. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and frequently appears on all major news outlets and writes regularly for Time.com and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. His latest book just out is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. And joining us now is Robert McChesney, who is the Gutzel Endowed Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He has written several books on media and politics, hosts the weekly talk show Media Matters, and along with John Nichols, co-founded the media reform organization Free Press. He's the author of Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy, and co-author with John Nichols of Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. His latest book just out is Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, Media, Politics, and the Struggle for Post-Capitalist Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert McChesney.
My pleasure to be here, Ian.
And obviously I want to talk to you about the idea of a post-capitalist democracy, but in light of the current events where, you know, in a social sense, the United States is going through a real dark night of the soul, in terms of race relations, in terms of the very notion of whether or not we are a just and colorblind society as we claim to be. And then we've just had an election where most of the political left in this country simply abdicated and didn't bother to vote. And already you see the consequences in terms of that old expression that you get the government that you deserve, even in this negotiation going on now to fund the government. The Republicans clearly have the upper hand, and Obama's probably not going to veto this bill. And what they're agreeing to is upping the amount that an individual can contribute to a national political party from $32,400 to $324,000, weakening the Dodd-Frank bill, making it more easy to do derivatives and swaps, blocking the Environmental Protection Agency's regulations, cutting the budgets of the EPA and of the IRS, and so on. So surely that is just a harbinger of how much worse things are going to get under the new Republican Congress in the next couple of years.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think we are in a dark time. You know, you could have added to that, I think, even as importantly, was the release of the torture report on the CIA's activities, which again, too, gets to some very dark aspects of what's going on in the United States in modern times.
Well, as it happens, Bob, you've been preceded by a former CIA officer, Robert Baer, who's extremely outspoken against torture, and the former chief of staff to Colin Powell, Lawrence Wilkerson, who was the first to blow the whistle on the Bush-Cheney White House's use of torture.
Well, very good. Well, you know, so in my book, what I argue is that, you know, the root cause of these issues of torture, of militarism, of spying, of the militarization of our police and this enormous sort of police culture and prison culture goes into sort of the basic failure nature of our capitalist system. That, you know, we have got a capitalism that's really in the downward slope of its positive contributions, and now increasingly is a parasitic capitalism, where the investors make their profits from privatizing government services or getting them outsourced, and not really producing a great deal of value, where they're taking jobs overseas if they're not replacing it with machines. That it's increasingly a regressive force, and it's bringing out the worst aspects of our culture. And if we're really serious about addressing the various problems you just talked about, we've got to really think about restructuring our economy to make it work on behalf of the people who live here rather than just the handful of investors who clearly own the government.
Well, just to touch again on the previous interviews about the torture regime, these two so-called psychologists who got $81 million of U.S. taxpayer money for recycling a Korean War-era pamphlet on preparing flyers who might get shot down over North Korea and get tortured by the Chinese who want them to confess, don't want actionable intelligence. The whole thing is such a fraud. It just, I guess, is just a window into that corruption that contracting has brought about. But one of the things that I find absolutely outrageous about the current predatory capitalism, how it's extended to people that don't even haven't even entered the workplace. It's bad enough to exploit people once they get a job, but the idea that our students today are put into debt before they even get a degree and then they can't find a job. Where did that come from? And it's all being orchestrated by Wall Street, as far as I can tell.
You know, I think that in the 1960s and 70s, capitalism sort of peaked out. It had a boom phase in the generation following the Second World War, the generation I grew up in, and I think you did too. And it was, you know, operating by historic standards at a rare level of high growth. And it was also a rare period in the history of capitalism in which economic inequality and poverty were both shrinking. And that process, when I was 20 years old, you know, 40 years ago, I sort of assumed that would just be how it always was under capitalism. And I remember my parents sort of laughing at me once because they lived through the Great Depression, and they didn't take for granted that we would always have a high-growth capitalism. And I could see what they mean now, because now we can look back at that period of the 50s and 60s and into the 70s as the anomaly, not as the rule of the day, but really the exception to the rule. And increasingly what we see today in the United States and worldwide is a capitalism with increasing inequality, increasing poverty. And for young people in particular, I think it's the bleakest it's been certainly in a century. Going back, you have to go back to the Great Depression. And even then in the Great Depression, I'm not sure in certain fundamental respects it was any bleaker than it is today in the United States and in countries all over the world. So these are dark times. I don't think this economy offers any way out. It is structured in such a way to benefit those at the top. And then the political economy, the governing system, is so much dominated now by wealth, and it permeates it, that we are really put in a spot where if we're going to seriously address our problems, we've got to change the entire system.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert McChesney, who is the Gutzel Endowed Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He has written several books on media and politics, hosts the weekly talk show Media Matters, and along with John Nichols, co-founded the media reform organization Free Press. He's the author of Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy, and co-author with John Nichols of Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. His latest book just out is Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, Media, Politics, and the Struggle for Post-Capitalist Democracy. So the period, the post-war period that you described, Bob, which, you know, arguably from about 1947 to 1977, the U.S. was a social democracy. And it's worth noting that under the Republican president, Dwight David Eisenhower, the richest Americans paid 92% income tax. But it seems to me that starting with Ronald Reagan, the whole system has changed. And is that because essentially Wall Street took over from Washington as the power center?
Well, following up on your notion that we were a social democracy in that period, And we certainly weren't a social democracy in the way Sweden was, is a social democracy, but Norway.
Compared to today, it's a pretty halcyon.
American history, yeah.
Sorry.
But I would say what happened was that in the late 60s and early 1970s, what happened was that the elites in the United States, especially connected to corporations and wealthy investors, looked at what was going on in the United States and to use the vernacular, they freaked out. They didn't like what they were seeing. They saw a society in which young people, to an astonishing extent, were hostile to big business, hostile to capitalism, hostile to corporations, and that their influence culturally was at an all-time low. And they feared that the social democracy you described was going to become much more intense, that the United States would move even further to the left, it would become much more egalitarian than it was even in the early 1970s. And it was at this point that the business community got very serious about politics. You know, we've talked, I believe, on this show in the past about the Powell Memo and the Chamber of Commerce's sort of call to arms in the early 1970s to American business to come in and take over the federal government, start lobbying more aggressively, make sure both political parties are always responding favorably to the needs of business. And they laid out a platform, a game plan, basically, that had two components. On one side, they had a series of proposals to make the government far less sympathetic to the poor and far less democratic and responsive. And you know, they did that by working to make the judiciary more conservative, to increase lobbying, to aggressively try to reduce taxes on the rich, and to reduce social programs that benefited the poor and middle class, get rid of unions. They wanted to basically make the country much more like America prior to the New Deal and in the Gilded Age. On the other hand, what they wanted to do, and it's really central to the project, was they wanted to depoliticize America. They understood that the crisis of democracy, as they called it in the 1970s, the corporate elites, was that there was too much democracy. The problem in America in 1970, 71, 72, was that traditionally apathetic communities, people of color, women, young people, working class people who were coming back from Vietnam, as radical as any generation of working class people since the 30s, were all very much open to dramatic and radical changes in society. This freaked them out, and they said, what we have to do is get traditionally apathetic people who are now getting uppity, we've got to get them apathetic again. We've got to get them to tune out politics. We've got to somehow make them just focus on their personal lives and not, you know, give a darn about politics and seeing the government as an agency that can actually do good for the world. And that was the conscious plan, and it's been, for the most part, extraordinarily successful. I've written about it at length with John Nichols and Dollarocracy. We have a whole chapter on it, really the book is about it. And that's what we're all responding to today. And I think if you look at what we need to do today to get this country righted, the place you would start is by resurrecting all the institutions that the corporate right has zeroed in on to destroy: fair elections, public education, credible news media, an independent judiciary, rule of law, a military that's accountable to the population. All these things that they've done away with, we have to get back.
So that is the roadmap that you have laid out for us in blowing the roof off the 21st century: media, politics, and the struggle for post-capitalist democracy. Robert McChesney.
Yes, it is. And what I would add to that is that when I talk about post-capitalist democracy, I use that term quite consciously, and I talk about it as some, like, why that term? Why not use a term like socialism? And, you know, I would consider myself a socialist, I do, but, I mean, it's a term that has so much different meaning to so many different people when you raise it. It has a lot of baggage. You spend so much time debating the nature of the term and all sorts of other issues, you forget about what really drives everyone to be concerned in the first place. I think we have to find common ground on those tangible issues where capitalism is clearly undermining a good life and undermining democracy. For example, what I call for in the book, let's take the profit out of war making. This was something that was central to this country's founding principles and really was the dominant ethos until the middle of the 20th century, was that making money off war was not only immoral, it was criminal. It was a scandal when people got rich from wars. They did in the Civil War, World War One.
You know, Franklin Roosevelt, when we entered World War II in December 1941, one of the first things he said was, he didn't want to see a single new millionaire created by the war, because that was the American tradition. That was considered antithetical to a free society, people getting rich from war and having, therefore, incentive to keep us permanently at war, because that's how they kept staying rich. And, you know, it was a scandal before that, of course, whenever we went to war and people made a fortune off it, which happened in the Civil War, which happened in World War One. And, you know, what we have today with our trillion-dollar military surveillance, national security grab-bag budget is basically something there for the rich companies, mostly monopolistic firms, to stick their paw in there and just grab, you know, $10 million, $100 million, $10 billion, $100 billion worth of public monies. It's completely antithetical to the democratic tradition. And it's not something that, that we can coexist. You can't have democracy coexisting with an unaccountable militarism that's driven by profit-making by the largest firms in the country that are making their money by hiring former generals to be their main lobbyists at seven-figure-a-year income. So we've got to basically take the profit out of militarism. That's what I mean by post-capitalist democracy. That is an effective thing. You start there, we probably can then begin to have sane talks about what genuine national security needs are, not something driven by the needs of wealthy investors.
So how do we bridge the gap? And in fact, the answer I know is that you've really made this argument in your book, but the gap between the apathy of the present moment where people feel defeated and, you know, the old, there's that old adage talking about capitalism, you know, if you give the capitalists enough rope, they'll hang themselves. Well, so far, the capitalists are doing very well, thank you, and we're all dangling from a rope. So how do you get from the position of now where people are weighed down by the present, and as you're arguing in your new book, Bob McChesney, there's these enormous possibilities of this historical moment that we inhabit out there that people simply are not aware of. So how do we get from A to B?
You know, I talk about this a lot in the book. When John Nichols and I went on our book tour for Dollarocracy in 2013, and we hit about 50 or 60 cities, and I think we concluded the tour in Los Angeles with you at UCLA, Ian, one of the things that was striking to us, that we did a strong critique of the role of money in politics and the corruption of our governing system and all the problems we've been talking about. And we had very little pushback from people in the audience. We probably spoke to around 10,000 people in that fall tour altogether, mostly enthusiastic responses. And we spoke to communities across the political spectrum, across the age and demographic spectrum. But what we found that was really striking was how much pessimism there was, how people had really, you know, said that, you know, okay, we get it. We understand how corrupt it is. We understand it's not working and that it's really not, you know, lasts very long without even more problems. But if the fix is in, it's hopeless. You can't change anything. And so part of this book is trying to put that response in context, to try to deal with the powerlessness people feel and the pessimism that grows from that. Because the problem is that pessimism becomes self-fulfilling. I mean, Chomsky put it best. If you act like social change for the better is impossible, you guarantee it will be impossible. I mean, that's the only thing we do control is how we respond to this moment and the moment of our lives. And what I talk about in the book that I think is very important is that it's impossible for people to predict the future. There's this heavy bias on us to see whatever is around us today, whatever we're experiencing now, and assume it's been that way yesterday and it's going to be like that tomorrow or maybe only worse. It's very hard to envision a brighter future. No one anticipates radical social change before it takes place. No one predicted the civil rights movement before it took place. Then once it comes along, everyone acts like they knew it was coming all along, all at the same time. No one predicted Occupy before it happened. No one predicted the Wisconsin uprising. These things caught everyone by surprise. And in my book, I tell this great story of a professor I had in graduate school who was a white South African who was very much opposed to apartheid and came to the United States in the 1960s, but still did all his research on the anti-apartheid movement on South African politics. And in 1988, when I was moving from Seattle to go to Wisconsin to take my job at the University of Wisconsin, I went to say goodbye to him in his office. And he said to me, you know, he was very depressed. I said, "What's wrong, Tony?" And he said, "Well, I've talked to my family and my friends and my comrades in Cape Town, and they tell me that the current government of South Africa will never negotiate with the ANC, will never abolish apartheid under any circumstances. And the only way," he said, "there would ever be justice in South Africa would be an immense amount of bloodshed and violence that would make the country unlivable for generations for anyone." That was in 1988. This is the most knowledgeable person I knew about South Africa making his firm projection for the immediate future. And guess what? 2 years later, Nelson Mandela was released from prison. 4 years after that, he was elected president of South Africa. And in that 6 years, there was probably less violence than you'd find in a New Jersey bar fight on a Saturday night. So my friend, who knew more about South Africa than anyone, was completely 180 degrees wrong. And I later learned that most of the South anti-apartheid activists at that time, even in South Africa, felt the same way as my friend. That was a common belief. And I learned from that something that's really crucial. You can't predict the future. It's simply beyond our capacity. All we can do is understand what's going on in the moment we live in, try to put it in context, make sense of it, so we're prepared for crises that inevitably will come, invariably come. And then when they do come, we can have humane, democratic responses, not, you know, paranoid, delusional, crazy responses.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Robert McChesney. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and we're continuing the conversation with Robert McChesney, who is the Gutzel Endowed Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And his latest book just out is Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, Media, Politics, and the Struggle for Post-Capitalist Democracy. And Bob, with what would you tell people in terms of both getting the intellectual ammunition that you provided them with in this new book, Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, and what can this become an organizing tool? I guess that's what I'm getting at.
Well, of course, that's any author's ambition, that certainly a political author. I would say that people are familiar at all with my book, but this is more of the same. It's new research, hard research on the state of American democracy, on militarism, on the prison industrial complex. And there's a lot of work on the media, new research on the importance of media and communication, the democratic and left politics around the world and in the United States in recent times, and a lot of talk about the actual political moment we're in. And I review some of the great campaigns of the last 15 years, the Nader campaign, the Occupy, the Wisconsin Uprising, and try to put them in context. And if I could say anything about the book, I would say that it is the most readable book. I mean, I wrote this book. The voice I write with in this book, more than anything else, is for the people I talk to, my students, my friends, not professors, not academics, although I think hopefully they will read it. But it's for people who just genuinely are citizens of this country who deeply care about its future, want to make sense of it, and, you know, don't want to be spoken down to. They want to be spoken to as fellow citizens. So I think it's been a popular book with those who read it. It's been very well received. I think it's an easy read, an enjoyable read, but there's a lot of meat there, too. Of course, what author is going to say they write a junky book? But I will also say this. What the book points to, Ian, is that media are really important. This is a key part of the book, is on media, their important role they play, an important role that nonprofit, non-commercial radio broadcasting in particular plays. I have a couple chapters on that. You know, as you've mentioned, for 10 years, I hosted a show on an NPR affiliate in Illinois from 2002 to 2012, a weekly interview program. And I saw firsthand the important role media could play in helping change the discussion on crucial issues, just from a little drop I could do with my show. I know you probably see it all the time. The listeners to KPFK, the listeners to any community station, understand that these stations are lifelines to the future. Issues like these, CIA torture, that comes a great news report on the mainstream news today and yesterday or in recent times. These were regular stories being covered in community radio by great journalists for the last 10 years. It's not a news story, a brand new news story there. It's a story that's been covered. It's only a brand new news story in the corporate media or in the more official media that take their cues from what people in power tell them for what they're allowed to cover and take seriously. And that underlines the crucial reason everyone listening to this show needs to make a pledge to support the station, to support this work, to support terrific programs like this one.
Well, I think you're describing there, Bob McChesney, a win-win. You know, the idea that your new book is going to help people get over the malaise and the depression of the political moment and start looking towards a future, and the book will empower them to see a way out of the current, you know, oligarchy under which we live, and how to restore the democracy. And also, of course, it helps independent media survive, and there's very precious little of it, you know, and Pacifica is one of the last places that doesn't take corporate underwriting, and there's no escaping it. At the heart of your new book, Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, Media Politics and the Struggle for a Post-Capitalist Democracy, is we're up against corporate power.
That's exactly what we're up against. It's completely central. And, you know, one of the issues that comes out in the book, that comes out in my work, that comes out for anyone who studies this very seriously, is that the people in power know how the system works. They understand that there's very few of them who benefit by having dominance over the very many of us. It's us at the bottom. They don't want us to have a similar understanding. You know, Warren Buffett put it best. He says there's class warfare in America, and my class is the only one that's involved in it, and we're winning. And, you know, we have to understand, when you look at, like I do, people in power and how they regard the situation, you get a lot of confidence, because when I study people in power, not just in the 1970s, but right through to today, you see they're scared to death. They understand that the people of this country are sleeping giant. And when something like Occupy happens, or when you see the mass uprising surrounding the police murders of unarmed citizens, as we saw in Ferguson and New York and Cleveland, in the other places, they get scared to death, because when people get out there and they stand together and they find that they are not alone, that the problems they've got are social problems, not individual psychoses, it gives them an immense amount of power. It's why the First Amendment protects the right to assemble. And when you experience that, as I did every day in Wisconsin 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, you understand that you've got the numbers on your side, and it is a tremendous confidence builder. And then the question is, how do we take this energy, mobilize it, and really succeed?
Again, I'm speaking with Robert McChesney, who is professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and his latest book just out is Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, Media, Politics, and the Struggle for Post-Capitalist Democracy. So when you take on the giant, you know, in the kind of David versus Goliath paradigm, Bob, it would seem to me that the last thing you can do is see the giant as being overwhelming and seeing the task ahead as being impossible. There has to be a sense that you can slay the giant. And I'm wondering how much the giant is going to slay itself, in the sense that American capitalism is 70% dependent upon people going to the malls and consumer spending. And Henry Ford pointed out that the capitalists have to pay their workers enough so that they can buy their product. Well, those days are over. They don't give a damn about whether people have any money anymore. They're just screwing everybody, and that is the new paradigm. And also, Wall Street itself is all about extracting wealth, not creating wealth. Even the robber barons created wealth while they extracted it. So do you think that American capitalism is going to hit the wall at some point?
Well, again, this gets us to the dilemma of trying to successfully predict the future. I think we can look at just what you described, the current tensions in American capitalism and world capitalism to a certain extent, and say this is not a tenable situation. Is there any reason to believe it will change for the better? Are there pressures around that are going to make this situation improve? And I would say there aren't. I mean, I think we look at the situation now. Take young people, take unemployment, and take the downward pressure on wages. Is there any reason to think that's going to get better in the next 10, 15, 20 years? Is there any reason to think this current lost generation that basically is lost a decade of income and jobs to a large extent, Is it going to be better for them in 10 years? Will the next generation of kids who come out of high school and go into college or into the labor market have it better? And every indication right now is that it will get worse, not better. The downward pressure on wages will be greater. Automation and technology is going to eliminate even more jobs and start eliminating jobs that we thought once were impervious to being replaced because of the power of computers. All of this tells us that things are going to be grim. We should be ready for darker moments. And as you pointed out, capitalism without people of income to spend money can't sell products. And the system is in deep trouble then. This goes back to the Great Depression and the causes of the Great Depression. Right now, we are in a crisis. It doesn't look like it's going to get better. So what we have to do, you know, what I avoid doing is like predict, well, in 9 years, this will happen or that'll happen. But, and, you know, we don't have to worry then because everything will work out once this happens or we can just give up. Rather, just try to understand it now and say, what would be solutions to these problems? What's a rational way to run an economy so people can have incomes and gainful employment? What's a rational way to run an economy so that the planet won't overheat and we can actually survive without disastrous environmental damage? And then start talking about those, planning those, studying those. How can we run a credit system? Get that discussion going and be in position then when crises do hit, as they will, that we're in position to offer something credible, coherent, thoughtful, and humane as an alternative to what will be left of those in power, with the arrogance of power, will be, I would think, very inhumane solutions unless we challenge them.
So is it possible then that we can find a way to use humor? I was your governor, Walker, who we all know from the efforts to recall him, which he survived, and he survived the last election. But he just sent a note to a Jewish organization and signed it off by, talking about the holidays, and signed it off with Molotov instead of Mazel Tov.
I saw that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just, and Ted Cruz and Perry, Governor Perry, all of this crowd that are running for president are just such clowns. I mean, they're just such empty shills for corporate America. And I'm just wondering whether at a certain point they'll self-destruct, or that we can find a way to recognize, you know, the hollow nature of these shills for the people who pay them. I mean, they're whores and hirelings of corporate America and of the billionaires, and that's the kind of government we're getting. But at some point or other, these hollow slogans of free enterprise, we know it's all garbage anyway, because the whole purpose of government now today is to enrich the people who own the government, not to recycle public money back to the public who pay their taxes.
You know, I think actually one of the bright sides is we have fantastic humor and political humor for the last two decades in the United States, and it's almost all critical. It runs very heavily left. In fact, you know, the few efforts of right-wingers to do humor, Fox News Channel had a show, I think it's called Red Eye, which is supposed to be their sort of their right-wing version of Colbert or The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And it was so hilariously bad, it was worth watching because it was so pathetic, because right-wing humor didn't really work well. It's very hard to be hip when your humor is based on racial put-down and sort of taking the side of the guy on top. As Charlie Chaplin put it best, you know, humor works best when you take the side of the little person, not the big person. It's not very funny to ridicule little people on behalf of big people. So we've got the humor thing down, and I'm glad we have it, and it's some brilliant humor. But I think we don't want to exaggerate humor, as great as it is. I mean, I remember I was at an event 14 years ago, and it was Ralph Nader was running for president, and Michael Moore was there. And Michael Moore introduced Ralph Nader. It was here in Madison, Wisconsin, and he gave a hilarious talk, like a 10 or 15-minute talk, and everyone's cracking up. And Nader stood up, and he came up, and you know, Nader actually has a pretty good sense of humor, but he said, you know, I think it's great we've got comedians here like Michael Moore who are really funny, who draw out the humor in our politics. But, you know, let's not think that that's enough, he said. And Nader told an interesting story. He said that back in the late 50s, when he'd just gotten out of law school, he had heard all about how horrible the Soviet Union was, so he wanted to go check it out himself. So Nader, being sort of guy he was, went to the Soviet Union, spent several months apparently traveling around the country just to get a handle on what the USSR was like at the height of the Cold War. And he said when he was there, he was struck by the genius of the political humor, that there was sort of an underground humor culture critical of the Soviet government and Soviet communism that was staggeringly brilliant. That was, he described that. He said it was just extraordinary. But, I mean, it reflected the fact that those who made the jokes had no power. They were powerless. And so while it was great that the humor was there to keep their sanity, you know, it wasn't enough. And he said it was also a reflection of the fact that the mainstream media, the Soviet media, Pravda, Tass, Izvestia, was so horrible that you had to have humor to have, make any sense of the world, that it had to be an alternative to the official line. And I think, you know, that was his point to say, look, we've got that situation here today. The reason why we have Jon Stewart and Colbert and Michael Moore is that the mainstream media is so deplorable. We need them to give us our bearings, to keep us sane. And that's a good way to circle back, I think, Ian, to the point of one of the issues we're trying to raise here, which is the sort of discussion you and I are having in this interview, the sort of discussion that goes on this show all the time and on this station frequently, it can't be heard in commercial media. It can almost never be heard on NPR. It's really limited to that part of the spectrum that's not under the thumb of the corporate system or of government politicians, and has real independence. And that's community media. And the only way it survives is by people who listen to shows like this, calling the number you're about to give them, making whatever pledge you can. You can get my book if you want it. I hope you get it. Get whatever premium is available to support the station. Only 10% of the people who listen to shows like this actually support the station, help pay the bills. If you're part of the 10%, I love you. If you're part of the 90%, it's time to look in the mirror, step up the plate, hit a home run.
Thank you so much for joining us, Bob.
It's really been my pleasure, Ian, and good luck with the show.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert McChesney, who is the Gutzel Endowed Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He has written several books on media and politics, hosts the weekly talk show Media Matters, and along with John Nichols, co-founded the media reform organization Free Press. He's the author of Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy, and co-author with John Nichols of Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. His latest book just out is Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, Media, Politics, and the Struggle for Post-Capitalist Democracy.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.